Hi everyone. So you know how I said last week that we would be getting back to regular schedule this week? Yeah, well, I totally lied about that. But that's okay because I'm here today to bring to you another podcast that I personally am super obsessed with, and that is the Jury Room podcast. I know you guys are gonna enjoy this one. I personally, like I said, listen to this one on almost a daily basis, so I know you guys are gonna love it. And we will actually be putting out a new episode on Friday, so be on the lookout for that, and I will see you guys then. Bye!
I just want to say thank you to Sarai from the Freaky AF podcast for featuring one of my episodes. On this episode, we're going to be visiting the story of Casey Anthony. Now, this was a two-part series that I did. This is part one. Definitely check it out. If you would like to go listen to part two, find the Jury Room podcast on any podcasting platforms that you can. Definitely let me know what you think. I have very strong feelings about this woman. I did two Aftermath episodes, so there's four episodes on this woman just alone if you'd like to come and check it out. Subscribe, leave a review, let me know how you're doing. You can reach out to me anytime, juryroompodcast@gmail.com. You can also reach out to me, and I would be happy to send you some stickers. Just reach out, juryroompodcast@gmail.com. And as always, stay safe. And thanks for listening.
The Oracle Network.
Making one person smile can change the world. Maybe not the whole world, but their world. Warning: the following podcast contains mature content. Listener discretion is advised. Hello. And welcome to the Jury Room, where we dissect some of the most heinous, some of the most unthinkable, and some of the most monstrous crimes to ever scar the earth. From cannibalistic serial killers, to decades-old unsolved mysteries, these stories are sinister enough to keep you up at night. Today, we will be doing the first of a two-part series on the notorious Casey Anthony, whose strange behavior following the disappearance of her toddler sparked a global media frenzy. Is she really the world's worst mother, as so many have called her? Did she murder her baby girl just to free herself of the responsibility of motherhood? Or is she innocent? In the first episode, we will cover Casey's upbringing all the way through the birth of her daughter, Kaylee, and Kaylee's disappearance. On the next episode, we will go into the shocking aftermath from those initial 911 calls to the discovery of the body and the shocking murder trial that ensued. Let's dive right in. This is Casey Anthony. From the time tourists arrive at the airport in Orlando, Florida, they are propelled into a world of fantasy and pretend. A courtyard in the center of the airport features dazzling palm trees and a cascading fountain, reminding travelers that this is a vacation destination. A place where real-life problems can be exchanged for magic and fantasy. Mickey Mouse waves from gift shop windows. Posters of a towering Hogwarts grace the terminal walls. Families march around in mouse ears and minion backpacks. Tickets to SeaWorld tucked safely beside handheld fans and sunscreen in their overstuffed fanny packs. It's a city built on the idea of manufactured fun. A promise that happiness is always just a theme park away that problems are something that not only can be, but should be escaped. Maybe that's why 22-year-old Orlando resident Casey Anthony made the decision she made on that fateful day in June 2008. Maybe she wanted to escape real life for a little while. Let go of her responsibilities, play pretend. Maybe that's why when her 2-year-old daughter Kaylee went missing, Casey didn't say or do a thing about it. She didn't report her daughter's disappearance for 31 long days. On the 30th day, Casey's father, George, got a call. His daughter's white Pontiac Sunfire had been found at a tow lot, where it had been gathering dust for 15 days. He arrived at the lot to retrieve it, and was struck immediately by a terrible stench, rotten enough to make his stomach churn. It had been a month since he had seen his granddaughter, and he had his suspicions about where she might be. He hadn't confronted his worst fears. Not yet. To do so would be to admit to something terrible, to acknowledge how he really felt, what he really suspected his own daughter could be capable of. Still, there was no denying the awful stench lingering around Casey's car. Could this smell be? Could little Kaylee be? He didn't even want to finish the thought. It was probably trash, he told himself. But he knew better. George Anthony had been a cop for much of his career. This smell, this stench, was not unfamiliar to him. It was unmistakable, the stench of death. Terrified of what he would uncover, he made his way to the trunk. Would he find Kaylee there, curled into a little ball, her light brown hair hanging lifelessly over her tiny cheeks and nose? Would he have to face the reality that his own daughter might have committed such an atrocity, that his precious granddaughter was really gone? He sucked in a breath and popped the trunk open. Inside was a lumpy trash bag, crawling with maggots. Hundreds of maggots. Casey Anthony was born in Warren, Ohio, in 1986, to parents Cindy and George Anthony. Her father, George, a sheriff, had been married once before to a woman named Terry. Their marriage lasted 5 years. According to Terry, George was nothing without his uniform. She claimed that George was a pathological liar with a gambling addiction, and that she wasn't able to trust him throughout their entire marriage. She finally left him when she couldn't take the lies anymore. It wasn't long before George met Cindy. She was a blonde, blue-eyed Ohio native who was working as a registered nurse. They married soon after meeting, and in the fall of 1982, welcomed their first child, Casey's older brother, Lee. 4 years later, little Casey was born, and Cindy struggled to raise 2 children and work full-time as a nurse. It has been said that Cindy ruled the Anthony household. What she said went. And George found it easier to let Cindy get her way than to become sucked into an argument with his wife. Cindy decided she wanted to leave her job as a nurse to dedicate her time to her kids. There was just one problem. George's paycheck wasn't big enough to support the whole family on its own. Cindy convinced George to leave his sheriff position after 10 years and find a job that would pay more money. He accepted a position, working for his father Lee at his small business, Anthony's Auto Shop. But things moved south pretty quickly. It's possible that George was resentful of having to trade in his career he had dedicated a decade of his life to in exchange for earning a paycheck from his father. To make matters worse, George and his father had a pretty troubled relationship. They were constantly arguing on the job. Their fights could erupt into violent anger quickly, and certainly disturbed the otherwise professional atmosphere of the auto shop. The longer George worked there, the more bitter he grew of his position, and one day he decided he had had enough. During a particularly nasty spat with his father, George hurled his dad through a glass window. That incident led to George's termination from his father's own shop. By now, Casey had been born, and George had another mouth to feed. Desperate, he took out a second mortgage on his home and used it to open an auto shop of his own. George's new business venture was daunting, to say the least. He was treading water in the deep end, realizing too late that he didn't really know what he was doing, or if he even wanted to do it in the first place. The auto shop closed down not long after opening. George, humiliated, lied to Cindy and told her that the business failed due to poor investments, rather than because of George's own shortcomings. George needed to prove himself. He was anxious to show his wife and children that he wasn't a failure. In 1987, he ran for county clerks of courts. He lost. The truth was, George wasn't happy no matter what he was doing, which likely hindered his ability to do anything very well. Interestingly, his dream was to work as a character at Disney World. But this wasn't a lucrative or realistic option for a father of two children in the late 1980s. Still, it's worth noting that Casey Anthony's father dreamt of a life of fantasy, of playing pretend. Soon, George moved his family to Orlando, Florida, possibly in an effort to get closer to his ultimate dream. Although he did not seem to take any of the steps to make that happen. In Orlando, he worked a number of jobs across a myriad of career paths. He seemed to be lost, unsure of what his place was or where he really fit. He had given up his dignified career as a police officer, and for what? His first job in Orlando was a route manager at a newspaper company, which he left to work for pest control. But a few injuries to his knee forced him to stop working entirely. Likely depressed and with a crushed spirit, he spent his days at home, hiding behind the glow of his computer screen. It wasn't long before George's gambling addiction came back at full force. He became addicted to online gambling and lost a lot of money at the same time. In all, the Anthonys were barely afloat when it came to finances. Casey, therefore, grew up in a household that was poor in cash, but rich in tension and frustration. The money problems in her family could not have been entirely hidden from the young girl, and it's probable that her parents' stress rubbed off on her and her brother, shaping their perception of the world. Still, Casey was a free-spirited, cheerful little girl who excelled at school, played volleyball, ran track, and had a large group of friends. She was known among her friends as a kind-hearted and goofy tomboy, carefree and full of life. That is, until she first stepped foot into Colonial High School. Then, the lies began. They started small. White lies about skipping class, or rushed explanations for missing homework assignments. Nothing too serious. But Casey learned quickly that lying was something she could do pretty well. It was almost like a skill. Some of her classmates were good at math or shredded on the soccer team. Casey could win a medal for her lies. It wasn't until her senior year, though, that her lies became more elaborate and bizarre. That year, she seemed to be doing everything right. Graduation was coming up, and the whole Anthony family was excited to watch their Casey get her diploma. She went shopping with her mom for the perfect graduation dress, and plans were in the works for some kind of celebration on the big day. Strangely, though, Cindy and George noticed that Casey's graduation cap and gown hadn't arrived in the mail yet. They asked their daughter if she was supposed to pick it up, or if something went wrong with the order. And Casey calmly explained that the school must have forgotten to order it. She promised to bring it to her school's attention in time for graduation day. A few weeks passed. Graduation was getting closer, and there was still no cap and gown. Cindy and George accepted that Casey was taking care of it, but they did worry she might not receive it in time. Still, that was their only concern.
And now, for a quick break.
The Evidence Locker is a weekly podcast about international true crime. Made by hardcore true crime fans, it's somewhat grungy.
Hi, I'm Marie from Leeds in the UK, and my favourite episode is Death in a Funeral Home.
Hi, I'm Liz from Melbourne, Australia. My favourite episode is The Disappearance of Lars Mittank from Bulgaria.
Hey, this is Will here from Cork in Ireland, and my favourite episode has to be Israel Murder at School. Fascinating story.
Hi there. My name's Conrad, and I'm from Lexington, Kentucky. And my favorite episode is the Atlas Vampire Murder.
Join us as we explore the dark corners of the globe. Find us on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Now, back to the show. It didn't occur to them that their daughter might be lying about why it never arrived in the mail. Then, Cindy got a phone call from the school guidance counselor just a few short days before the ceremony. He asked her and George to come to the school as soon as possible so he could meet with them regarding concerns he had about Casey. Shell-shocked and confused, George and Cindy sat in the counselor's office, eager to hear what could possibly be wrong. He told them, quite frankly, that Casey had not attended classes in weeks, and that she was not going to be graduating as a result. She didn't have enough credits. Cindy and George immediately confronted Casey about this issue. Casey would have known for months that she was in danger of not finishing high school. But she claimed that her lack of credits was because she didn't realize that some classes only counted as half credits. She acted completely blindsided and saddened by the graduation news, and her parents readily ate up her story. While it might seem hard to believe that Cindy and George were so accepting of their daughter's lies, keep in mind that she had never told a lie quite this huge before. To them, she was their perfect daughter, excelling in school, popular, and happy as can be. They really had no reason to think she was hiding anything from them, and the idea that she might not graduate felt unfathomable. Finally, graduation day came, and George and Cindy invited close friends and family members to celebrate Casey's achievement. after everyone watched the entire ceremony and didn't see Casey walk? Cindy explained that Casey was graduating, but there was some mistakes with her credits, and she wasn't allowed to walk. Still, she assured them, Casey would be getting her diploma, and it would all be sorted out soon. After the ceremony, everyone was invited to their home for a big graduation party. Casey was showered in gifts and checks from her friends and family, and gladly accepted them. Even though she knew, she had not actually graduated. Even Cindy and George, who knew that the credit problems were likely not going to be solved anytime soon, toasted to their perfect little girl. Casey was learning that lying and deceit were sort of her superpower. People seemed to just believe whatever she said, and no one really tried to dig too deep into her stories. Her parents could have contacted the school and demanded to see a list of credits she had missed, but they chose not to. Unwilling to face the reality that something might be wrong with their daughter. So instead, they indulged her. They threw her this big party. She was showered in money and gifts. And she went to sleep that night having learned a valuable lesson that would remain with her for the rest of her life. That she can get away with anything. Following the high school graduation, a diplomaless Casey found a job working at a Kodak camera stand at Universal Studios. She continued to live with her family, but did not use her small paycheck to help them with their struggling finances. It was at Universal that she met Jesse Grund, a Universal Studios loss prevention officer. Jesse was struck by Anthony immediately, drawn to her zest for life and her confidence. The two dove headfirst into a serious relationship. When she wasn't at work or with her new boyfriend, Casey spent time with her family. The foundation of the household was shaking, however. Cindy had grown tired of George's gambling problems and kicked him out of the house. The two were separated and seriously considering divorce. Casey must have been affected by the separation, as well as the growing tension in the Anthony household. Still, the Anthonys were close to their extended family of cousins, aunts, and uncles, and would meet up from time to time for family gatherings. Cindy and George continued to attend these parties together, even after the separation. At one such gathering, her uncle noticed that Casey looked heavier than usual and assumed she must be pregnant. He casually asked Cindy when Casey's baby was due, and Cindy got extremely defensive, insisting that Casey was a virgin and had just gained some weight recently. Shortly after the family party, Casey went with her boyfriend Jesse to meet his parents for the first time. He was excited to introduce her as his girlfriend, and eager for them to be as captivated and charmed by her as he was. Instead of the excited and happy reaction he expected, though, Jesse's parents seemed rather uncomfortable around Casey. Jesse's parents pulled their son to the side and asked why he was dating a pregnant woman. Shocked and confused, Jesse explained that Casey was simply carrying some extra water weight. He told them that they'd never even had sex, and that Casey was actually a virgin. His parents insisted, though, that she was carrying a child. Casey was clearly covering something up. She was looking more pregnant by the day, until it was almost impossible to deny it anymore. Still, Cindy and George jumped through hoops to explain away the weight gain. Even when Casey's brother Lee implied that Casey might be pregnant, his parents shut him down and told him not to bring up the subject anymore or tell anyone else. It wasn't until Casey was 7 months pregnant that she finally confessed what she had been hiding, not so convincingly hiding. Instead of reacting with anger or being upset that Casey had been blatantly lying to them, George and Cindy were ecstatic to welcome a new grandchild into the home. Jesse did not react with the same level of enthusiasm. Casey was 7 months pregnant, but she and Jesse had only been together for 5 months. It just didn't make sense. Every time he confronted Casey about this pretty glaring problem, Casey became hysterical, crying and shouting until Jesse just stopped asking anymore. Little Kaylee Marie Anthony made her arrival on August 9th, 2005. Casey told everyone that Jesse was the father, and against his better judgment, he did attend the birth of Kaylee and stepped into the role, at least at first, of the doting new dad. The hospital room was a little crowded when Casey was giving birth. Jesse, George, and Cindy were all in the room, giddy with anticipation. When Kaylee was born, Cindy insisted on being the first person to hold the newborn child, even before allowing Casey, the baby's mother, to hold her. She scooped the infant up in her arms and remarked that holding Kaylee felt like just holding Casey when she was born. Could those critical first seconds in Kaylee's life have impacted her relationship with her mother? Is it possible that because Casey did not get to be the first person to cuddle her sweet new baby, that her bond with her child was affected? That she didn't feel as connected to her as she could have? Regardless, after the birth, the family headed back to home to begin their lives with this new baby. At first, things were going relatively smoothly. Casey was a devoted and happy new mom, who cherished her new baby and dedicated herself to being the best mother she could be. After a few months, though, when the shine of motherhood started to wear and the realities of late-night diaper changes and financial responsibilities became clear, Casey grew slightly more resentful. She yearned for a sense of freedom and escape, and felt that her baby was sort of an interruption to her otherwise perfect and carefree life. She started to attend more parties and leave the baby with Cindy, who loved any chance she got to spend with her granddaughter. Still, although Casey's love for motherhood was faltering, she did remain a kind and caring mother towards her daughter. She never acted in anger toward her or lashed out at her. Her friends and family described her as sweet and committed to little Kaylee whenever they were together. In the meantime, Jesse was an extremely present figure in the baby's life for the first year. He genuinely loved the little girl and was dedicated to being her father. He did get a paternity test just to find out officially whether he was really her father, but he claimed even if he wasn't, he planned to adopt the baby and raise her as his own, alongside Casey. When the test came back and proved that Jesse had not fathered the little girl, it did not affect his love for her. Cindy, however, was adamantly against Jesse adopting the baby. She did not trust him or think he was good enough for her daughter. And her own marital struggles clouded the way she saw the relationships of others. She refused to accept that Jesse was a stable young man who sincerely loved Casey and Kaylee, especially when she knew that he wasn't even the baby's real father. at the same time, Cindy did not want Casey to leave the home or to take Haley away. Remember, I mentioned earlier that in the Anthony household, it was Cindy's way or the highway. She ruled the household and relished in the control she had over her family. She wanted to be able to maintain control over Casey's life and of Kaylee's, and knew that if Casey were to start a life with Jesse, she would lose that chance. As a result, Jesse never really felt welcome in the Anthony home. He was constantly berated by Cindy and was tired of watching her control so much of Casey and Kaylee's lives. It was difficult for him to feel like he belonged in the family. At the same time, he was losing touch with Casey that he had fallen in love with. He told Dr. Phil in an interview, "There was behavioral changes in Casey. She was turning into a different person. And basically, she said that I loved Kaylee more than I loved her." This was a constant problem for Casey Anthony. She did not like having to compete for love and attention with her new daughter, and felt that she should remain the center of attention in her friends' and family's lives. As time went on, Casey grew more and more resentful of the attention Kaylee was showered with. Jesse could no longer stand to be with Casey. Although he genuinely loved the woman she once was.
And now, for a quick break.
I'm going to preface this by saying that, you know, I'm not naming any names. However, one thing I've learned, in a word to the wise, don't trust any bitch named Jen. Let me tell you something, bitch. Let me tell you something, bitch. Let me tell you something, bitch. The dick snapped harder than Judy Funny at a poetry slam. Let me tell you something, bitch. We are living in the aftermath of Reaganomics. Let me tell you something, bitch. Go eye for an eye with me and end up with astigmatism, honey. Let me tell you something. If you're going to listen to this podcast and you recognize my voice, don't play any of it for either one of my grandmamas, okay? They done survived this pandemic, and this might kill them. Let me tell you something, bitch. I remain anonymous to protect the guilty. Let me tell you something, bitch. Streaming everywhere.
Now, back to the show.
It was too difficult to be around her erratic behavior and jealousy. He remained a figure in Kaylee's life following the breakup. But Casey no longer allowed him to think of himself as the baby's father. No one really knows who the real father of Kaylee Anthony is. There are quite a few suspects that Casey has named. But no one officially stepped up into the role or was proven to be the real dad. Bizarrely, two of the men that Casey named, Eric Baker and David Ortiz, both died in car accidents before the child was born. David Ortiz was a man that Casey dated before she met Jesse. And Eric Baker, well, no one knows if he's even real. There's never been any proof that he existed. And Casey conveniently claimed that he had been killed when her parents pressed her for more information about him. Regardless, by the time Jesse and Casey broke things off, Kaylee was being raised primarily by Cindy and George. In the end, the couple did not want to spend the money it takes to get a divorce, and Cindy somewhat begrudgingly invited George to move back in with her. Now, the quaint ranch-style Orlando house was filled to the brim with Cindy, George, Casey, and baby Kaylee. At this time, Casey was leaving the house 5 days a week for a new position she had landed at Universal Studios. She told her parents that she was working as an event manager for the theme park. Cindy babysat Kaylee every day when Casey left for work. In the meantime, George had found a stable job as a security guard, and Cindy was still working as a nurse. Things seemed to be looking up for the family. Still, George and Cindy were a bit confused about some of the behavior Casey exhibited during this time. At least 5 times since Kaylee was born, Casey's car had run out of gas and George had to come rescue her. Finally, George started keeping extra gas canisters just so he could have them at the ready. Casey had also started stealing money from the family. At first, she would take any cash she found lying around the house, or, bizarrely, take change from Kaylee's piggy bank. The stealing hit an all-time high when it was time for little Kaylee's 2nd birthday. Casey was in charge of picking up the cake and decorations for the party, which she did, no problem at all. After the party, though, Casey's grandmother discovered that some checks were missing from her checkbook. She traced them and discovered that they were used by Casey to buy the birthday decorations and cake. Casey's grandmother, deeply upset, called Cindy to inform her of the stealing, and Cindy denied that it could have even happened. After all, Casey has a stable job and has no reason to steal anything. About a month later, Casey stole Cindy's credit card and used it to make a large number of purchases. No longer able to deny the difficult truth, Cindy confronted her daughter about the theft. Casey explained to her mother that her paychecks aren't ready to be picked up yet, and that she needed money until they finally arrived. What Cindy and George failed to realize was that Casey wasn't actually an event manager at Universal Studios. In fact, she didn't even have a job at all. She hadn't worked in ages. No one knows where she was going or what she was doing during those long days, 5 days a week. When she left her daughter at home, but one thing's for certain, she wasn't going to work. During that time, she also told her family that she met a man named Jeff Hopkins at work. Hopkins had a son, Zachary, who was Kaylee's age, which Casey was especially excited about. Cindy and George were thrilled that Casey might have found love and asked Casey to invite him to dinner. Casey agreed and went out of her way to plan the whole evening. Her parents cooked a big feast in anticipation, and Casey was particularly giddy with excitement. Just before he was supposed to arrive, however, Casey told her parents that she had received a text message from Jeff, saying that Zachary is sick. Jeff was not able to attend the dinner after all. They rescheduled the dinner multiple times, but each time, Jeff canceled at the last possible minute. Finally, Casey told her parents that Jeff had actually moved out of the state, so they wouldn't be able to meet him after all. In May of 2008, 1 month before Kaylee disappeared and shortly after Casey claimed her boyfriend Jeff moved away, she met a new man, Tony Lazzaro, on Facebook. She and Tony attended a few parties together, and things grew serious quickly. Casey was happy to be getting a little wild with Tony and leaving some of her responsibilities behind. Their relationship escalated extremely quickly, and she claimed to be falling in love with Lazzaro just a few weeks after meeting him. After meeting Lazzaro, Casey's behavior became more and more erratic. She spent a ton of time with her new boyfriend, sleeping at his apartment night after night, leaving her daughter with Cindy most of the time. She did bring Kaylee to Lazaro's apartment every once in a while, and Lazaro claimed that Casey was a good mother, acting caring and kind toward the toddler whenever she saw them together. While she was getting closer with Tony, she was also lying more and more to her friends and family. She told her best friend that her parents would be moving out of the house and leaving it to Casey, and that Amy should move in with her. This was a complete lie. Cindy and George had no plans to move, but it does make me wonder if Casey had been planning on making her parents vanish too. Casey even allowed Amy to apply for a change of address and invited her on a shopping trip to gather things for the new house. Casey seemed to be building up some kind of freedom fantasy in her head. She was the only one of her friends with a child, and as a result, the only one with real responsibilities. It's possible that Casey had created a fantasy where she could have all the same freedoms as her friends. Living with Amy was a way for her to get there. Still, her parents had no plans to move. So why go through the great lengths of this lie and allow Amy to actually purchase things for the new house? While Casey was leading Amy on about the house, she was also throwing herself into a new venture. Every Friday, Tony Lazaro would run a big promotion at a local nightclub, Fusion Ultra. Casey had become obsessed with helping him on those nights and thought of herself as his manager. She helped with everything, from managing the cocktail waitresses to social media promotions. Spending Fridays at the club was incredibly freeing for Casey. After a few weeks of club promoting, Casey began distancing herself from Amy, maybe so that she didn't have to tell her that they would not actually be moving in together. On multiple occasions, Casey stood Amy up and made up lies about why she couldn't make it. Once, she even told Amy that her father had suffered a heart attack and she had to drive him to the hospital. That was not true at all. Suffice it to say, Casey seemed to be more focused on partying and creating lies than caring for her young daughter. On the night of June 15th, 2008, Cindy had finally had enough, and she and Casey got into a big fight. Cindy had discovered that when Casey claimed to be at work, she had actually been out promoting Lazaro's clubs and partying. According to true crime researcher and writer Stephanie Harlow, Cindy actually threatened Casey that night that she would take custody of little Kaylee. At 7 a.m. on June 16th, 2008, Cindy left for work. George took care of Kaylee that morning, feeding her breakfast and spending time with her, while Kaylee flirted with a man named Ryan on Facebook. Casey remained on the computer working on promotions for Fusion Ultra throughout the morning. At 12:50 p.m., George said that Casey told him she was going to work and dropping Kaylee off with the babysitter. George noticed that both Kaylee and Casey were wearing backpacks when they left the house. Around 2:30 p.m., George left the house to go to work. Strangely, even though Casey and George both supposedly left the house by 2:30, Investigators later found computer activity inside the home all the way up until 4:11 p.m. It is possible that Casey left the home with Kaylee to appear that she was going to work, parked somewhere near the home, and hung around until George left for work, and then came back to the house when she was sure no one else was at home. At 2:52, Jesse Grund called Casey to check up on her and Kaylee. During that call, Casey told Jesse that her parents were divorcing and that she would be moving out. In reality, Casey's parents had made no indication to her that they were going to divorce. Between 4:10 and 4:14, Casey made 6 calls to her mother. None of them were answered. Investigators found that her cell phone could be traced to a tower near the Anthony house until 4:11 p.m., when it was traced to a tower near Tony Lazzaro's apartment. Casey met up with Lazzaro around 4:11 and spent the rest of the evening with him. Lazzaro later told police that Casey was acting completely normally and even cheerful. At 7:54 p.m., the two were seen at a Blockbuster Video without Kaylee. They rented 2 movies and headed back to Lazzaro's place. It is clear that sometime between when George said goodbye to Casey and Kaylee around 12:50 p.m., and when Casey was seen at Blockbuster Video without Kaylee at 8 p.m., the little girl disappeared for good. It is widely believed that she was killed during this time. For the next 31 days, Casey Anthony's behavior would not reflect that of a grieving or worried mother. Of course, everyone does grieve differently, but if she truly believed her daughter was missing, then her behavior seems questionable at best. On the morning of June 17th, one day after Kaylee disappeared, Casey returned home while her parents were off at work.
And now, for a quick break.
I'm Whitney.
And I'm Melissa.
We are podcast addicts.
Fascinated with true crime.
Winos.
Boy moms.
And both live in Texas.
We became best friends almost instantly
when we discovered our obsession with true crime, Pinot Grigio, and all things macabre.
We decided to bring our love of wine and podcasts to you.
Join us on our weekly adventures as we branch out on new wines and cover crimes from across the nation.
We will discuss everything from cults to kidnappings to murders and all that fall in between.
Pop a cork or grab a glass.
This is Cults, Crimes, and Cabernet.
Now, back to the show.
She gathered some of her things. She officially started sleeping at Tony's house. She remained at Tony's house for the next month and dedicated her time to caring for him and his 2 roommates almost like a mother. She did their dishes, cleaned their house, and cooked their dinner. When Tony asked where Kaylee was, Casey would say that she was with the nanny or with Cindy. On June 18th, she returned to her parents' home again and asked a neighbor to borrow a shovel. She took the shovel for about an hour before returning it. The neighbor reported that Casey was not acting abnormally. On June 20th, Casey went to Fusion with Tony for their usual Friday night club promotion. She entered a hot body contest that night and dozens of photographs were taken of her. Photographs that would one day make front page news. In them, she looks happy and carefree. She told friends at the club that Kaylee was away with a babysitter, who she lovingly referred to as Zanny the Nanny. After that night, George and Cindy reached out to Casey to ask when she would be coming home. Casey told them that she had moved in with Kaylee's new nanny, Zanny. In reality, she was still living with Tony Lazzaro. Still, she told her mom that Zanny spends so much time with Kaylee that it just made sense to move in with her. Multiple times over the next month, Cindy would reach out to Casey and ask where Kaylee was. Every time, Casey had a story ready. Her most common lies were that Kaylee was with Zanny at Disney World, Universal Studios, or SeaWorld. Cindy did not question how Kaylee could afford all those theme park tickets along with paying her nanny. She can't even scrape up the funds to put gas in her car. Cindy did notice that Casey left all of Kaylee's clothes and toys at Cindy and George's house. But when she asked Casey if she wanted to retrieve them, Casey told her that Zanny has a whole set of outfits for Kaylee at her house, and that they even went shopping and bought new toys for her. On two occasions during this time, Casey drove her Pontiac Sunfire with other people in the car. The first time, she was driving her brother Lee when he complained about a terrible smell in the car. Casey told him that a squirrel had died in the exhaust pipe. On another occasion, Casey was driving with her friend Amy, who complained that it smelt like death in the vehicle. That time, Casey explained that she had hit a squirrel with her car and it had gotten stuck on the front bumper and that the smell hadn't gone away. On June 23rd, Casey and Tony went to the Anthony household to steal some gas from George's canister collection. The next morning, George noticed that the gas was stolen and the lock to the shed was broken. He called the police to report the stolen canisters. On June 25th, Casey walked into the Anthony household when she thought her father would be at work. She didn't realize he'd actually taken the day off. This is the first time George had seen Casey in weeks. Casey tried to make the visit as quick as possible, explaining she had only had time to grab some things and then get going again. George, struck by Casey's bizarre behavior, came to the conclusion that Casey stole the gas canisters. He confronted her about it, and after denying it at first, a fight eventually escalated. Finally, Casey finally opened her trunk and threw the gas canisters at George, shouting, "Here's your fucking gas cans, Dad." 1 week later, Casey parked her car next to a dumpster besides the check cashing business, claiming to have run out of gas. The car was subsequently towed away. Casey made no attempt to retrieve it. On July 2nd, Casey went to a tattoo parlor and got the words Bella Vita tattooed on her shoulder. Bella Vita means beautiful life in Italian. She did not tell her tattoo artist what the meaning was behind the tattoo and was on her cell phone the entire time she was getting it. Around this time, Casey also stole her best friend Amy's checkbook and spent over $600 of her friend's money, practically draining her bank account. 2 weeks after she had left her car beside the dumpster, George Anthony got a call that his daughter's car had been sitting in a tow lot for the last 2 weeks. By then, he had grown pretty worried about Casey's bizarre behavior, anger outbursts, and the fact that he hadn't seen his granddaughter in weeks. When she arrived to pick up the car, he was hit with a terrible stench, which smelled, in his words, like a decomposing body. Terrified that his granddaughter might be in the trunk, he warily pulled it open to find a lumpy trash bag crawling with hundreds of maggots. He opened the trash bag to find rotting pizza and garbage. To his great relief, his granddaughter was not inside. The next day, on July 15th, George angrily called Casey and demanded that she come to the house to get her car. When she arrived without her daughter, she said that Kaylee was out with Zanny the nanny. Cindy and George, though, had had enough. They were growing more and more suspicious by the minute and were determined to get to the bottom of where their granddaughter might be. That day, a series of 3 911 calls were made from the Anthony household, and Kaylee was officially declared a missing person. It would be 6 more months before the little girl was found dead, a half a mile from the Anthony home. Join us on the next episode as we dive into the harrowing 911 calls and discovery of the body, and the arrest and trial of Casey Anthony. Will she be able to lie her way out of a guilty verdict? We will find out. Thanks for listening. And remember, you never know what's lurking in the shadows, lingering around the corner, walking past your house at night. So watch out, stay safe, and keep listening. This has been The Jury Room. Thanks for listening to part one of the Casey Anthony series. Don't forget to get your submissions in on your thoughts and feelings about this woman. Everyone's submissions will be read aloud in the Jury Room Aftermath Part 2 episode. So get your submissions in now, juryroompodcast@gmail.com. As always, stay safe, and thanks for listening.
Hello?
Hello, this is a free call from...
Casey.
An inmate from the Orange County Correctional Center for a rape quote.
People lie to cops every day. Cops lie to people every day. I am just one of the unfortunate idiots who admitted that they lied. In the second of our two-part series on Casey Anthony, we are making our way through her tunnel of lies in an attempt to decipher what really happened to Kaylee Anthony on that fateful June day in 2008. From desperate 911 calls by Casey's own mother to the discovery of little Kaylee's body and the trial that ensued. This is Casey Anthony Part 2. Buckle up, it's going to be a wild ride. The Jury Room Podcast can be found on most podcasting platforms. Make sure you go subscribe, follow, leave a review anywhere you can. And as always, stay safe, and thanks for listening.